Hi, everybody. John Fetterson here from the North Carolina Reading Service with this issue of Independent, the Indie Week. The issue is dated February the 27th of 2025, and it's read by John Fetterson. I'll mention that it is intended for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners from the NC Reading Service. Let's get going. All right, and we'll get started over at Duke University. Two articles from them. Duke went carbon neutral in 2024. What's next for its climate commitment? Last year, we reported on the state of the university's 2022 climate commitment with the verdict that, if given the money and mandate to succeed, it could be a model for how an organization, especially one of the wealthiest universities in the world, could use its unique position to address the climate crisis. Buoyed by the fulfillment of the 2007 goal to reach carbon neutrality, the commitment received applause from institution insiders and skepticism from students, some of whom argued that the commitment was hypocritical as long as Duke declined to divest its endowment from fossil fuel companies. At the time, Toddie Steelman, university's vice president and vice provost for climate and sustainability, said, quote, "Our actions speak louder than the words, and the skeptics should stay tuned for future goals and projects." We checked back in with Steelman to ask about ongoing projects and its next big goal, net zero emissions by 2050. This is a Q&A, question and answer. We first reported on the commitment back in April of 24. What have you all been up to in the past year? And replies Toddie Steelman. We published an annual report documenting more than 70 activities, projects, and programs that are popping up across every corner of the university. One of the most exciting aspects of that annual report is that we crowdsourced it because we wanted folks from across the university to tell us what they were doing. We had projects in education, in our research space, in our operations space, in our community engagement space, some of which we had no idea were even going on. I'm most excited about the progress that we're making on climate fluency. One of our goals is to create a climate fluent campus so that every major is a climate major and every career becomes a climate career, because climate change is going to affect everybody everywhere. In order to do that, we've had a committee of faculty, staff, and students that's been working to develop a framework that will allow each school to develop its own version of climate fluency. Because you wouldn't want a student to become climate fluent the same way in nursing that you might want them to be in engineering. So we're trying to find those pathways that allow each school to put its imprint on where we're going. Question. Duke recently reached the big goal of carbon neutrality, which was a big goal set decades ago. What's the next big goal to shoot for? We achieved carbon neutrality last year, which was very exciting for us. We are ahead of our peers in many respects on that front. We did it with carbon offsets, but we have also made enormous investments in renewable energy. We have a 100 megawatt off-campus solar project that will come online this year. We've made investments of more than $400 million in infrastructure and efficiencies to get us to where we are today. In addition to needing carbon offsets, because we're not all the way there in decarbonizing our own campus, having achieved neutrality, we are not content to rest there. What we want to do now is established a net zero goal for 2050. We have a committee that's meeting now that will help us chart that path towards what it means to achieve a net zero goal, along with interim goals that allow us to really hold ourselves accountable to make progress in order to reach that goal. In addition to that more ambitious goal, we now want to include our Duke University health system, which was not included before. That basically expands our footprint by more than 60% in terms of what we need to do. It's exciting for us to have both the opportunity and the challenge of trying to figure out how we're going to do that. What's the difference between carbon neutrality and net zero emissions? Being carbon neutral basically means you're going to have an amount of carbon that you're going to put out in the atmosphere every year, and then you're going to match that with an amount of carbon offsets to make sure you come back to neutral every year. Whereas net zero, what you're trying to do is decarbonize your entire entity as much as possible, and you reserve the use of carbon offsets for that very last increment. So the idea is to force you to decarbonize as much as you can, then reserve the use of these offsets for the last little increment that is irresolvable just because of the way we function in society. What impact do you think the new federal administration may have on Duke's initiatives and goals? We're only a couple of weeks into this new administration, and they've made a lot of bold moves. There's been the articulation of a very clear energy security agenda in this administration. There are clear ideas where our CERT research dovetails nicely with that, including projects we were already going to be doing that we will certainly continue. We continue to stand fully behind our climate commitment, so we'll continue to push forward in all the areas where we said we were going to be working before, including education, research, and external engagement. It may mean there are fewer research dollars in some areas. It may mean new opportunities are opening up where we might be doing things that we hadn't fully considered in the past. We also have to be smart about how we position ourselves to take advantage of those opportunities, and I think we also do not need to compromise on our values as we do that. Have recent climate disasters like Hurricane Helene and the LA wildfires brought more attention or student interest to the commitment, or have you seen that translate into energy on campus? Whenever you have a true climate disaster in your state like Hurricane Helene, it brings home why we need to be doing this work. And we see some of the work we're already doing becomes more applicable to places like Western North Carolina. A good example is a project that we had in Eastern North Carolina after Hurricanes Florence and Dorian hit Carteret County, where our marine lab is, in 2018 and 2019. We have an amazing faculty member down there, Liz DeMattia, who has worked with the Boys and Girls Clubs of Carteret to create what she and local teachers call a resilience curriculum, to work with K-12 students to talk about what it means to be resilient as an individual and a community. They use art and storytelling as a way to process what can be really hard feelings when your community is going through a disaster like that. Teachers in Western North Carolina heard about this curriculum and reached out to collaborate on setting something similar up in the wake of Helene. That's just really a tiny sliver of a story of how the work that has been going on since 2018 becomes relevant when you have a disaster take place in another part of the state, and we've got faculty, staff, and students who can help in that particular way. Let's see. We want our neighbors in Western North Carolina to recover and be as vibrant as they were before and to do our part in that. People will say it's a 1-in-1,000-year kind of event, but statistics like that are really not very helpful to us anymore because these events have become more common and those numbers make it seem like we're immune to these potential events when actually we are not. So it just brings it more home when you have something like this happen in your backyard. Are there any parts of the commitment's future plan that readers in the Triangle in North Carolina might find particularly relevant? We have a variety of research projects that are located in Durham and in North Carolina. This wasn't directly about the commitment, but we launched the Community Engagement Center last week. President Vincent Price was there with Mayor Leonardo Williams and Vice President for Durham and Community Affairs, Stephanie Williams. Stealthily Williams. We're integrated into that work because we want to be plugged into Durham, Carteret County, and other places where we have a presence. And this hub will be a matchmaking center for a lot of work we're going to do, including climate-related work. We have another project that is working with North Carolina state offices to create new insurance products. There's a real challenge to insurance markets right now because the price of risk you pay for insurance is too low for the actual risk we face when it comes to hurricanes and wildfires. So we've got a group that is working with underserved and overburdened rural communities in North Carolina to figure out how we can get them more access to risk management tools so they can protect themselves from climate change. Question. The divestment conversation seems to be ongoing on campus. When we last spoke, you said you didn't agree that divestment was the right way forward, but that you were glad that students were bringing it up and pushing forward. How is that conversation going? Answer. We are a mission-driven institution that has a climate commitment. We also primarily have a fiduciary responsibility to manage the endowment in a way that has a return on investment that supports a variety of activities we do across the university, financial aid, funding research, funding professorships. So when we think about an endowment, we have to think about first, what is it accomplishing for us, and what is our fiduciary duty? At the same time, we have a climate commitment, and we want to make sure we are living our values in terms of what that means. It comes back to the question of if divestment is the right way for us to think about that. I would say I'm not sure, because divestment is a really blunt tool for us to accomplish what might be a larger goal of, let's say, decarbonizing our portfolio. What does it mean to do that in a financially responsible way? I can't say there's anybody out there who has really figured this out. And so what we have done is to create a research project, leaning into our research mission as a university, so we have faculty, staff, and students looking into how can we understand actually what the carbon footprint is of our portfolio, if we wanted to ask that larger question about how we decarbonize it. So we're working in partnership with our friends at DUMAC, that's the investment arm of the university, and trying to genuinely understand that question. And if we make progress on that, I think it will be helpful not only to us, but to everybody in the field who is wrestling with that question. When we published that last year, I got a lot of skeptical emails. What do you generally say to someone who doesn't believe that Duke actually stands behind the commitment or that it is actually making a difference? There are two things I would say, and that depends on what direction the conversation is going. On one hand, I'm genuinely interested in why somebody would have those doubts. What are you hearing? What are you not seeing? What can I show you about what we're doing? Because I've devoted my entire life to this. It's something I fully believe in. So tell me more about why you don't believe it's real, because I genuinely want to know why. The other piece is, genuinely, let me show you what we are doing. We just put out this annual report showing there are over 70 projects in every corner of the university. I guarantee you we'll have more next year as it grows and grows and grows. There are always going to be people who are skeptical of large institutions like Duke. I understand that. But I would ask they don't let their cynicism of what we're doing get in the way of something that is truly needed in society at this moment. The work we're doing here at Duke is serving as a beacon for many other places. I'm not going to convince everybody, and that's okay. I want to spend my time working with those people who really want to affect change and do something meaningful. Final question. Is there anything I didn't ask about that you want to share in this update? And she answers, last week, we partnered with athletics and Liberty Mutual to have a sustainable women's basketball game. Student athletes from across the university got together and got donations of used athletic equipment they are going to repurpose. The women's basketball team wore recycled polycotton shirts that were made from waste products. In between quarters of a game, we had a celebration of the work that's gone on across the university. It's just a really great example about how when we enlist the help of students, and believe me, this is student-driven, we get so many great creative ideas about how we can all be more sustainable and lean into this climate commitment. Now, folks, I'm fully aware that this station, radio station, is dedicated to blind and print-impaired listeners. There may be other family members or other people who are not so, who is along a spectrum of visual impairment. So when I read things like movie advertisements, not advertisements, but notices in the calendar, I do what I can. I just read them sketchily. There are some events that are, I would have to say, primarily visual. And this next one is about the cherry blossom season coming up, of course, in our nation's capital, but also right over at Duke Gardens. And so I think it's worth reading. I'm sure that many of you out there will be have an opportunity, or hope you do have an opportunity for you or loved ones, to go over to Duke Gardens and get whatever you can from this exciting time. Unfortunately, this article is about disruptions for the center for the gardens, and so I better get into it. The annual spectacle is about to collide with construction crews at Duke Gardens' $30 million renovation just launched 3 weeks before the garden's busiest month of the year. Construction began Monday on the Garden Gateway Project, a redesign that will bring a new welcome center and improved accessibility to this 55-acre garden campus. Both main parking lots will be closed for the year-long renovation, as well as the entrance on Anderson Street, and all formal events are suspended until this project completes itself. Well, the trees are still going to bloom, folks. So the timing, which was delayed from an original fall date, creates unique challenges. You bet it does. A record-breaking 155,000 people visited Duke Gardens last March, drawn to the Cherry Alley, a dreamy tunnel of cherry blossoms where visitors angle for the perfect shot beneath a pink canopy. This year's pilgrimage will require some creative navigation. Construction fencing will create a dead end at Cherry Alley, typically accessed through the main Gothic Gates entrance, meaning visitors will need to wind their way through other parts of the garden to reach the blossoms. Now, there's many, many details about this. I'm not going to read the entire article, but there is on the Duke Gardens website and, in fact, on Indie Week, the online version of what I'm reading right now, a map and a couple of maps of the layout. But I will just say that with no on-site parking available during construction, getting to the gardens will take some extra steps. Weekday visitors should plan to bike, walk, or take a bus. There are several Go Durham and Go Triangle routes which drop off nearby. On weekends, parking will be available at the H lot on Anderson Street with a temporary entrance on Lewis Street. You can also enter through gates along Flowers Drive, which connects to the West Campus. The renovation, which has been in the works for a decade, is an effort to address long-standing issues with visitor engagement and safety. Currently, many guests bypass that visitor center entirely, missing out on resources and programming. The new Welcome Center will serve as a central hub. Visitors will pass through it to enter the gardens, complete with a gallery, cafe, and outdoor meeting areas, while the existing Doris Duke Center will be renovated to focus exclusively on events. So, enough of that. Just note that it's coming up in just a couple weeks beginning. Visitors can find more information and regular updates at this website, gardens.duke.edu. And there's a Cherry Blossoms web page. And I'll just cut that one off for now. And there's a thing. I have never gone there, and I lived in North Carolina for more than 30 years. And so maybe this won't be the year for me, but it may be for some of you, and it may be worthwhile. All right, let's move on. And let's talk about a new book related to titled The Cold-Blooded Murder of Booker T. Spicely. And that book released is at Hayti Heritage Center Friday, 7 p.m. Hayti Heritage Center will be having Mike Wiley telling the story of Booker T. Spicely. I guess it's not, well, it's either a book. I'll see what it is. In 1944, Booker T. Spicely, a private in the U.S. Army on active duty, got off a bus and a stop at Durham's Club Boulevard near what is now the North Carolina School of Science and Math. The bus driver, Herman Lee Council, followed him off the bus and shot him twice in the chest. After being refused treatment at the segregated Watts Hospital, Spicely was taken to Duke Hospital and pronounced dead on arrival. Eyewitnesses who said Spicely, who was unarmed and in uniform, had lightly protested when he was asked to move to the back of the bus when several white soldiers boarded. Despite acquiescing and moving seats, Council followed Spicely when he got off the bus and shot him. At a subsequent trial, the all-white jury accepted Council's claim of self-defense and acquitted him after only 20 minutes of deliberation. After being buried in Durham history for many years, Spicely's murder and other acts of racial violence in other towns like this have prompted new commemorations and conversations. Last year, actor and playwright Mike Wiley premiered Changing Same, a one-man play he wrote with local poet and playwright Howard Kraft about Spicely's murder. This play is the ninth in Wiley's library of historical shows that he now travels the country performing. That's what we will attend if you go on February 28th at 7 p.m. to the Hayti Center. The show is directed by Joseph Magel and features music by Corby Hill. Ahead of the show's February 28th performance at Hayti, the Indie spoke with Wiley as he drove between performances down in Georgia. Question. Changing Same premiered last year to mark the 80th anniversary of this murder. Why is it back now at Hayti Heritage? Answer. The Booker Spicely Committee is partnering with the Legacy of Lynching Conference, which is happening at the Friday Center that weekend. That conference brings together representatives from across the state and from the various counties that have had lynchings in the past, and because the killing of Private Spicely can be categorized as a lynching, the performance of this on Friday night is kind of kicking off that weekend of the Legacies of Lynching Conference. Question. Tell me about first connecting with the Spicely Committee and where you start in building a play about a historical person. I know very little about Booker T. Spicely a couple of years ago, or knew very little, and it's a story that needed to be told. It's in some ways an open secret in that not a lot of people were talking or about it or remembering it outside of those individuals on this committee who came together to start working on, first and foremost, a marker where he was killed in front of that School of Science and Math. They also wanted other institutions in the area to acknowledge the killing of Private Spicely and wanted there to be some larger acknowledgement, more than just a marker, something that was going to touch the hearts, minds, and souls of not just people in Durham, but maybe even folks across the state of the country, to remember that this happened. The committee reached out to ask if I would be willing to write a play. At the time, I was knee-deep in writing a holiday play with my writing partner, Howard Kraft, for Playmakers Repertory at Chapel Hill. And because Howard and I work so very well together, it was a no-brainer for him to come on board. That meant the two of us were working on two plays at the same time and going back and forth on each piece. I have a nephew, Jackson Leonard, who just graduated from Appalachian State. He is a historian, and I asked if he would help us out with the research. Typically, I do all the research myself, but that can be fairly heavy because not only am I in the process of writing the piece, but also figuring out how to create characters, how to stage the piece, so on and so forth. Jackson did a deep dive and started sending me large swaths of research, so Howard and I could then dive in and get a little more granular with that, find specific moments and specific individuals to dramatize. Once Howard came on board to co-write, I asked Joseph Nagel to eventually produce it on stage. I asked Corby Hill to join us and play some live Piedmont blues music throughout the piece. We pulled together a draft that we wanted to present to the public as a staged reading, which we premiered on July 7th at the North Star Church of the Arts, one day before the 80th anniversary of the death. We had a lovely, packed crowd there for the reading, and we had a fantastic response from that audience, including relatives of Spicely and members of the Spicely Committee. Regarding the research of the piece, it is a deep dive into as much information as we can find, and in finding that information, deciding what can be dramatized, what story we want to tell, and how we want to tell it. Of course, we want to tell as much as we can, as much as we know, which isn't a whole lot, about who Booker Spicely was, reading letters his brother sent to Thurgood Marshall and the NAACP in defense of his brother, and hoping there would be a fair trial of Herman Council, the man who killed Spicely, as well as what the rest of the community of Durham at the time was saying about the murder. What they were saying about counsel, and of course, what actually happened that night on July 8th, 1944. When Spicely boards a bus there in Durham to go back to Camp Butner, and he sits the second seat from the back of the bus. In no way was he in front of the bus, and in no way disobeying segregation laws. When counsel, the bus driver, asked him to get up and move to the back, he did. According to eyewitnesses, on the way to the seat in the back, he may have jokingly said a few things like, "I thought I was fighting this war for democracy. It seems strange I'm wearing the same uniform these white soldiers are wearing, fighting for the same freedom, the same democracy. It seems odd. I cannot sit in the same seats that they occupy." The bus driver had words and had a different opinion about that and kept pushing it. Moments later, when Spicely decided to exit the bus and back, eyewitnesses said he apologized to Herman Council. Why did he apologize? I suppose it was the person he was. Council followed Spicely off the bus, approached him with a pistol, and then shot him twice in the chest. Spicely fell into the street. The bus driver reboarded the bus, put his pistol away, and drove off. Spicely was taken by police, oddly enough, to Watts Hospital, which was the all-white hospital at the time. They took him there, and the doctor, of course, said, "I can't treat him." The police forced the doctor to give him a blood alcohol test. Again, why? We're not altogether certain, but it seems they were trying to help counsel to say that Spicely was drinking and being belligerent. He wasn't drinking, nor was he being belligerent. They eventually took him to Duke Hospital, where he passed away. In a court, of course, counsel was acquitted of all charges in only 28 minutes of deliberation. Question: in other plays, you've portrayed famous characters like Jackie Robinson. Is it different trying to embody someone like Spicely, who is not as historically well known? Not really. With any piece, I try to find specific stories. I try and find those parts of that history within those events or within those individuals' personal history that is unknown, that's rarely talked about, then make up what and who that person is or who and what that event eventually becomes. And so I can approach it in the same way, trying to tell the stories from multiple angles as well as I possibly can. As it was once said to me, there are three truths, your truth, my truth, and the truth. And the actual truth is somewhere in the center of that. And I try and tell a story from as many angles as I can so that we can get closer and closer, as close as we can get to the actual truth. How do you approach telling the story of someone like Spicely who was violently murdered without letting that abrupt and violent end define their entire life? I try and recreate the human being. I try and learn as much as I can about that person who lived, and in portraying them, I try and embody them as a human being who had hopes, dreams, a sense of humor. That ultimately makes the untimely death, the killing of these individuals, as much more tragic in an audience's heart, because now it's not just a news article. This is an individual who lived, breathed, had a family that grieves for them. If I'm doing my job well, the audience grieves. Is there anything that I didn't ask about that you think readers should know? Mostly, I want to thank the Spicely Committee for giving me an opportunity to help tell a story that happened not only in Durham, but also elsewhere in the South. The play gives me the opportunity to present that Durham story in other communities across the country that are trying to figure out ways to tell the story of their lynchings and killings. Perhaps they'll see this play and think they could similarly tell their stories so that future audiences can learn not just about Private Spicely, but about other individuals across the country that were tragically taken from us before their time. So this program that I'm reading to you now will be first heard Friday afternoon. And when you hear it, you'll know that that night, Friday evening at the Haytai Heritage Center, 7 p.m. will be Changing Same, The Cold-Blooded Murder of Booker T. Spicely. Information about how to find tickets, but I bet you could look at the website for the Haytai Heritage Center and see what the availability is, if there is any cost or whatever. And let's go on now. Continuing with another piece of Durham history, a pride march, a protest, and the mayor who survived it all, revisiting a pivotal Durham moment. This article relates to a gathering at the public library in January 25th. At about 80 people settled into their seats in the auditorium at Durham County Library, Eddie Davis, a former city council member and longtime teacher, scanned the crowd. Davis asked how many in the audience weren't in Durham in 1986. Nearly half of the hands in the room shot up. Davis nodded, acknowledging that many in the audience had no first hand of the events that unfolded that year. At the far end of that panel, former Durham Mayor Wib Gully adjusted his plaid shirt as he prepared to recount the fight that nearly cost him his job. Leaders from a defining moment in Durham's history gathered at that library on January 25th to discuss the city's first gay pride march and that political battle that erupted around it. The event brought together longtime activists, former city leaders, and community members who lived through 1986, a year when Durham found itself at an unexpected crossroads. That summer, when Gully signed an anti-discrimination proclamation, a fierce backlash followed. More than four decades later, those who fought that backlash reunited, a brain trust of Durham's past leaders, to reflect on the lessons it holds today. Mab Segrest, longtime activist and panelist, told the audience, "To me, the story of the recall and its defeat is the story of that door, that portal, that opening, when a community decides to stand up for itself." What began as a grassroots effort to organize a pride march escalated after Gully signed that proclamation affirming Durham's LGBTQ residents. A coalition, including some conservative religious leaders, launched a campaign to recall him. Gulley said in the interview afterwards. Nobody quite anticipated the reaction, but it was huge. It captivated the community. For weeks, the recall consumed the city. Letters to the editor flooded Durham newspapers. Tables popped up across the city, some collecting signatures to demand Gulley's removal, others mobilizing to defend him. Gulley said, "How did Durham become what it is today? I think more than anything else, the story of what happened in 1986 was a key, pivotal point." Meredith Emmett, now a nonprofit leader, was a young activist in 1986, and she recalls hatching plans for a pride march in Durham over a potluck dinner. "It was a different city then," she said. "When I first came to Durham, the tobacco factories were still operating downtown. There was a very active Ku Klux Klan presence." She and her co-organizers planned strategically. They trained peacekeepers for the march, built alliances with other progressive groups, and asked Gulley to sign a proclamation to get a prominent politician to take a stance. "Gulley was glad to sign it. It was not something I thought about for 3 seconds," he said. The Durham Morning Herald weighed in even before he signed. A few days before, the paper's lead editorial read, quote, "There is a fine line between showing the courage of one's conviction and brain damage. Mayor Whip Gulley is about to cross that line." Former panelist Steve Shule, former Durham mayor and incidentally co-founder of The Independent, he told Gulley, "First of all, we thank you for crossing that line and showing the courage of your convictions." Shule compared the backlash to Gulley's proclamation to today's attacks on gay rights. Quote, "The far right always aims to hate somebody, and now it's our trans friends and neighbors, our immigrant friends and neighbors, and our refugee friends and neighbors who are bearing the brunt of this vitriol." For Shule and other panelists, the recall fight wasn't just about one mayor's decision. It was Durham choosing what the city would be. Organizers who opposed the recall built coalitions across racial and political lines. Reverend Joe Harford, former pastor of First Presbyterian Church, recalled how faith leaders joined the fight. Activist and scholar Leah Wise spoke about engaging Durham's black community in LGBTQ rights. Resistance played out everywhere. Petition tables, radio ads, door-to-door mobilization. And he said, Leah Wise said, "This editorial isn't just a reasoned disagreement about policy. It's a screed, an angry, hate-filled yelp that reminds me of the language that we read today in the attacks on trans people, their allies and advocates." Emmett said, "No one part of that alliance could have defeated the recall. Joe Harvard couldn't have done it alone. The People's Alliance couldn't have defended their candidate that they had elected to be mayor. They needed other alliances. White people couldn't have done it alone. The gay and lesbian community certainly didn't have the political strength to do it. It was all those alliances that made it possible." For Shule, that moment in 1986 carries eerie echoes today. For instance, he mentioned the Idaho legislature's recent call to repeal laws granting marriage equality for same-sex couples. He told fellow panelists, "Even victories we thought were secure are endangered. We knew what happened with Roe v. Wade, how the right to reproductive freedom was taken away, and so we have to be concerned that these other rights are under fire, and we need to work hard to make sure they are protected. I don't believe that that will happen," he added, "but I think that the effort to recall WIB in 1986, the pride march that took place amidst this turmoil, and the organizing to stop the recall as a time of danger, danger to live as an elected official, danger to our vision of a progressive Durham, and danger, most of all, to our LGBTQ residents." This recent panel is part of a broader effort to document Durham's history from that summer. Gulley started the project 3 years ago when he connected with Duke professor Andrew Nurkin and UNC Chapel Hill PhD student Hooper Schultz to compile archival materials and conduct oral histories. This year, the group plans to launch an exhibit with the Museum of Durham History and work toward producing a documentary on the recall battle. Gully afterwards said, "How can Durham's past help us stand up for justice today? The recall battle can help us face some of the threats of bigotry and intolerance that are out there." In the end, the 1986 recall effort failed. Organizers could not gather enough signatures to force an election. Gully said that was seen as a pretty stunning result. Ordinary people stood up and said, "No, that's not who Durham is, and that's not what we're going to be or want to see this community be. We want to take a different path." While Durham now has a reputation for progressive policies, that was not the case in 1986. He said that in the 70s and early 80s, many saw the city as conservative and resistant to change. Quote, "Everybody, both in and surrounding Durham, in the state region, thought of Durham as this blue-collar, predominantly white, conservative, rednecky place." But 1986 proved otherwise. Gully said it helped shape the city's identity as one that prides itself on inclusion. On June 28, 1986, the Triangle Lesbian and Gay Alliance held Durham's first annual Pride March with the theme, "Out Today, Out to Stay." According to a Durham County Library history exhibit, up to 1,000 people marched from the 9th Street to the Durham Reservoir on Hillsborough Road. As the years passed, Gully realized how little known that recall battle had become, saying, "I began to realize about 3-4 years ago the stuff that may have had real critical impact on how things turned out can get lost in the sands of time." Now 76, he hopes to pass the story on to younger generations. Quote, "It was good, not just for people who were gay or lesbian in Durham. It was good for everyone in Durham. It's certainly a story I don't want Durham to forget. But for better or worse, it's a story that has great relevance to urban communities all over America today." Emmett agrees. For her, one lesson of that moment is the power of alliances, saying, "We're always stronger together. No one piece of any alliance can win big on big issues. You've got to work with other people. And they may be people you don't agree with on everything, but you agree on something, and you work together on that something." Another lesson of 1986, Emmett said, is about honest conversations. "We are a town willing to have public conversations about who we want to be. What was so evident from that 86 story is how much we used to have those conversations. The ability that we will have public conversations has been and is a really important part of who Durham is." Our next more or less regular weekly entry in Indie Week is called Indie Selects, What to Do in the Triangle This Week. And it's just a curated list from two editors from Indie Week, and based in different venues and in different focuses. This first one, February 28th, tomorrow in Saxapahaw at the Haw River Ballroom. And I say tomorrow, February the 28th, 5 p.m. Disenfranchised Disco is the recommendation. While disenfranchisement is hardly cause for celebration, it's certainly a reason to practice creative catharsis. We're now 3 months into an unremitting state judicial race battle, with Republican Judge Jefferson Griffin has sought to block incumbent Allison Riggs' recertification, despite her lead over Griffin. In response, Griffin mounted a campaign to cast out 60,000 valid votes he claims are illegal. If you are one of the 60,000 North Carolinians whose vote is being challenged, or if you simply love democracy, This Haw River Ballroom event is a chance to dance under the ballroom's famous disco lights and dance, plan, rejuvenate, make friends, and make a difference. It's a free 3-hour-long event, 5 p.m., Haw River Ballroom, Saxapahaw, February the 28th. Just dance. Now, March the 1st at Durham Performing Arts, DPAC, Alton Brown, the cooking maven and frequent video show and actually television show and website expert on cooking, will be at DPAC at 7:30 p.m. March 1st, the mad scientist of culinary television, hanging up his lab coat, but not before one final performance. He's been here before. His iconoclastic show, Good Eats, forever changed food to TV with his blend of quirky humor and scientific explanation, is bringing his farewell tour to Durham. So this would be at DPAC, and you will have to look about that as for what the ticket prices and availability are. I'll just leave it at that. It's March the 1st, 7:30 p.m. at DPAC. Now, all week, February 27th, that's when I'm recording this, to March the 2nd, the Pure Life Theater is presenting a program called Jitney, which is in Raleigh at the Leggett Theater. That's at various times. It's a play by August Wilson, I believe he wrote the music, man. Lively drama, Jitney, transports theatergoers to the 1970s era Hill, a predominantly black neighborhood in Pittsburgh where a group of unlicensed cab drivers navigate life, love, and struggle. Jitney is one of Wilson's 10-edition Pittsburgh cycle plays, capturing life in the Steel City. And this is the Leggett, L-E-G-G-E-T-T, Leggett Theater. Check for times on various dates. They happen in different times. And admission prices. And another event to see, it says here, is the Nevermore Film Festival over in Durham from Friday the 28th to March 2nd at various times. If you are a film buff and lover of the dark, terrifying, and fantastic, then your weekend is about to be booked. The very scary Nevermore Film Festival, a juried competition so long running that it could, in human form, legally rent a car this year. Programming kicks off on Friday the 28th with The Damnation, continued with 17 more films that dabble in classic themes, exorcism, time travel, Ouija board, vampires, and the like. Nevermore is hosted online and in person. If you're not able to make it to the Carolina Theater, you can still buy virtual passes. Individual tickets are $10, and if you're very committed, a full festival pass is $100. So you would go to the Nevermore Film Festival at the Carolina Theater in Durham, and it will begin on Friday. And finally, to attend March the 3rd in the ArtSpace Studio, Current, in Chapel Hill, 7:30 p.m., This is America 2. It's a 5-part series produced by Carolina Performing Arts' first-ever curator-in-residence, Johnny Gandelsman. Developed in the fraught months of 2020, the series, Gandelsman writes in the event program, is, quote, a vivid counterpoint to the idea that this land can be understood through a singular dominant point of view, and will offer perspectives on universal topics like separation, loneliness, hope, and love. Violinists Christina Curtin and ensemble Leal, Checker, and Sarafand feature in this second installment in the series. And This is America is going on through April as well. But March the 3rd at 7:30, Current Art Space is presenting the second one of the series. And so you can go look at the Current Art Space and find out more details. There's following three individual tickets start at $29. So that concludes this brief article. And, of course, culled from maybe 100 or more events in the area, counted. This is what some has caught the eye of these editors at IndyWeek. Now from Raleigh, actually, West Raleigh residents want to keep Athens Drive Community Library local. And this is a long article which I will not read almost any of. It involves public meetings and the Athens Drive Library, which now is housed in the Athens Drive High School and has been for many years. The Library Commission is now proposing to move it away to some other location. And this article basically says why some local people would certainly like to see a library there, not just for high school students, but also the general public. And it's a four-page article, and I will just remind everybody that IndyWeek is available online at indyweek.com. And if you're interested in that specific aspect of what's going on in Raleigh, the capital city, about public libraries, check it out, read that article, or see it, or have it read to you for yourself. And I'll just move on now. And why am I moving on, and why is there so many articles? That is because last week we were closed at the time it came for me to record this Indie Week, and because of snow. And it's 78 degrees, so I've been granted permission to come tunnel through all the snowdrifts back into the studio. So Chatham Rabbits want to be real with you. This is a music-related article. And finally, we've got something more auditory. This is a three-pager and may take me to the end of the broadcast. We'll see. Over the course of the Married Americana Duo's past three albums, Chatham Rabbit's Voices from the Past are resurrected by Sarah's 1921 banjo and Austin's 1941 Gibson guitar. A sharecropper, a rambler, and a pack horse librarian share a songwriting universe with figures from the couple's respective family histories and uncommissioned songs, figures from the family lore of fans. Even the duo's brand name, Chatham Rabbits, is an interpretive nod to the past. In the late 19th century, the Piedmont was home to a flourishing food way, the Eastern Cottontail Rabbit Trade. Upon buying a mill house in Bynum several years ago, the McCormies also discovered that their home was once occupied by a musician in a string band named the Chatham Rabbits that played for nearby mill workers. Once you start digging, the past always provides. So, released on February the 14th, Be Real With Me takes a different approach to this material. New textures, drum machines, synthesizers, pedal steel, layer the duo's traditional sound, pulling it forward alongside a more personal style of songwriting that takes the McCombies from their late 20s to early 30s. The wistfulness reflected in the songs is a matured kind of yearning, one that regards the past and the future in equal measure. Sarah tells Indy, "We could not have made this album without the life experience that predated it." I met Sarah, writes the author, about 2013, before the formation of Chatham Rabbits, when we both worked at Saxapahaw's Haw River Ballroom. I remember being impressed by her hustle. She'd show up in a homespun vintage dress, stash her banjo behind the coffee bar during a shift, then take off afterward for a gig. That work ethic has threaded through the McCombies' career. In 2018, the pair quit their jobs as a teacher and financial analyst to take on the risky dual venture of being full-time musicians and moving to Guilford County to manage this 64-acre farm that has been in Sarah's family since the mid-1700s. That's a prosaic enough story on paper, but being a musician in 2025 also requires being realistic about health care and the algorithm. Ahead of a February 22nd and 3rd two-night show at Haw River Ballroom, and on the heels of this release of the album, Indy had a candid conversation with Sarah McCombie about complicated friendships, contemplating motherhood as a musician, and beating the system. And this, folks, is a three-page question and answer, and I will not read that either. Just to let you know, you can get this album, get the details of this interview, and more talk about the album itself at IndieWeek.com. The artistic side, Chatham Rabbits Want to Be Real with You, is the title of it. Again, I must curtail this and not bring it back. And so I'm trusting on you if you're interested in this sort of music. Learn about more about it yourselves and go to IndieWeek.com. I will read about a minute of a Durham Jazz Scene article on a frigid Saturday night. Snow still sticking to the ground, I approach the Sharp 9 Gallery. A velvet curtain swings open to reveal an intimate space, rows of candlelit tables, a petite bar in the back that serves as a love letter to New York City's Village Vanguard. For the past decade plus, Sharp 9, which was founded in 2012, has been a locus of the Durham jazz scene. It's a robust scene, one bolstered by North Carolina Central University's jazz program and the greats that have come out of it, but one that can often fly under the radar, especially to people who are new to the city or younger residents like me who don't know where to start. At Sharp 9, I sip a generous glass of Pinot Grigio and munch on chips as the room fills with a gregarious crowd that has the camaraderie of a high school homecoming game. Up first, a performance by the Joseph Foglia Quintet. Foglia, an Enloe High graduate who now working in New York, leads the band with Triangle native Luca Colonna on piano and Killian Wynn on bass. Local powerhouses Al Strong on trumpet and Devin Fuller on drums complete the group. This article, I believe, is timeless enough that I will continue to keep it in my folder for next week's broadcast or following week, because it's not related to a specific performance. And having made that statement, I'll make the usual end of broadcast disclaimer. I have several articles that have accumulated in that week due to the snow closure, and I'll keep them in my folder and hope to get to some of them. There are a lot of cultural things. For the nonce, I'm John Feddersen. For the ncreadingservice.org, where this podcast will first be broadcast on Friday, the 28th, and it'll be available through the mists of time in the podcast section. So, for ncreadingservice.com, John Feddersen, for Indie Week, so long, folks.